Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Ron Paul Liberty Report. With me today is Daniel McAdams, our co-host. Daniel, good to see you.
How are you this morning, Dr. Paul?
Doing well.
Good.
And today we have a great program, a special guest, and been looking forward to this because we get to ask the questions. We don't have to have all the information. We're going to learn from our guest. And his name is Tom Luongo, and he's more prevalent on the internet lately. I've seen his name in all the articles. He's a libertarian journalist, and you know, he has a newsletter. It's called Gold, Goats, and Guns newsletter. Anybody with a newsletter like that has to be a good guy.
Yeah, for sure.
But what I don't understand, he's raising chickens, but someday he's going to raise goats. So I don't know when he's... He better not put chicken in his, the title of his newsletter.
No, no.
Anyway, Tom, we're delighted to have you with us. Welcome to our program.
Good morning, Dr. Paul. Good morning, Daniel. Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, good. Now, Tom, as I understand, you started off in some scientific understanding in chemistry, but there's no doubt that you're a good libertarian journalist, and you, I asked, you know, to get some more information. What's his expertise? And I was told everything. He knows... He knows economics, and he knows politics, and he knows foreign policy. So I think we have a lot to talk about. I imagine we won't get all our questions in, but we are delighted that that you're with us. But I want to ask a general question first to get us started, because we even agitate on air when we're talking about foreign policy, because some days we support Trump and some days we don't. You know, when he does something good, we want to encourage him. But when he's not doing so well, we say, oh, Donde, he changed his mind. Do you agitate over that, or you just totally ignore it, trying to figure out where's he coming from? What, does he have a philosophy, or is he just off the wall when it comes to solving problems?
I've come to the conclusion that Trump is hopeless on foreign policy, and it pains me to say that because I really thought that he had a clue, but I do not believe it anymore. There's the adage in geopolitics and politics in general that personnel is policy, and right now personnel in the Trump administration is nothing but arch neocon. And so with Bolton and Pompeo and Pence and the rest of them, and Haspel and the rest, so a picture has emerged in the last few months that it's really clear, certainly since the midterm elections, that Trump is pushing what he called himself, and what I've been continuing to pick up on, his energy dominance policy, which is that he's going to make the world pay more for energy to make us more, make our energy that we produce more competitive on the open market, and to retard our allies like Germany and others, who he feels are stealing from us, which is insane, as well as attack China on trade and all of this other stuff, while at the same time trying to at least nominally pull back on the empire, which I do applaud, right? I applaud the idea that he would pull the troops out of Syria. But we see a report this morning that he just cut a deal with Iraq to, if they do move the troops out of Syria, which John Bolton doesn't want him to do, they're just going to move them into Iraq. So they're not actually going to come home. Mm-hmm. So what's the point? So the empire is not going to end under Trump's watch, because Trump is not a strong enough person to stand up to the neocons and say, no, we're not doing this. And that's been my very painful realization over the last, you know, 4 or 5 months, that it's all just for show at this point. I think it's all just for reelection purposes at this point, to say what he has to say, to try and keep his base on his side, who are rapidly willing to back him because they see every attack against him as unfair. And, you know, I've always sat in the middle on Trump, hoping that he wouldn't be a warmongering mercantilist, and he's turned into a warmongering mercantilist, and worse without a clue.
Yeah.
And with the worst people around him.
And I think what you're describing is what I think 99% of all the politicians I've come across have the same goal, and that is not philosophy, not principles, not liberty. It's what am I going to do to accommodate so I can get reelected? That's where they spend their time. I think Daniel has a question for you.
Well, Tom, I have to say, you're a reader's writer, which I really appreciate and like. You know, you you put together a piece. It's a nice little chunk. It's not too much to bite off. There's a lot of stuff in there. But really, I love reading readers, writers, and that's the kind you are. So I highly recommend our viewers to take a look at Tom's blog, and we'll put a link, of course, in the description. But you had a blistering piece, a really good piece on these two very important summits that a lot of Americans may have missed, or certainly may have missed the undertones of what really happened. And to me, it seems like a real shifting of geopolitical sand after the Warsaw Summit, mm-hmm. otherwise known as the Hey, Let's Make War on Iran Summit, and the Munich Summit, which is Hey, Let's Make War on Russia and China Summit. And and both of them flopped. I mean, it's pretty well accepted that Pence totally flopped, totally flubbed it. Right. He was hysterical at Warsaw, claiming that Iran was planning the next Holocaust. They were going to have a Holocaust against Israel and Jewish people, begging the Europeans to go along with UN sanctions, stop trying to trade, get rid of the deal, drop the deal. He even said, this is actually a sort of an admission of defeat. It's not just a compliance issue. It's that the Iran deal wasn't no good, accepting that they've been in compliance with the deal. Tell us a little bit from your piece. Let our readers know a little bit about what you were thinking about the summit.
All summits, and then you can't just remember the two summits that we organized or that we were part of. There was also at the same time the Russians, the Iranians, and the Turks getting together in Sochi to further work on a political solution in Syria, right? And that was actually quite illuminating because Putin's statements afterwards addressed all of our supposed fears that we've been promulgating in the Western media about, well, what would happen if we pulled out of Syria, right? Then the Turks would slaughter the Kurds and all of this stuff. And Putin made it abundantly clear that he's got Turkish President Erdogan on a short leash. So there's no worry there, and that he's still for the territorial integrity of Syria, which of course we're not. So the biggest problem here is that what I was saying in the article was that it's really obvious that Germany and, to a lesser extent, France and others are no longer willing to go along with our edicts unilaterally. They want their own foreign policy, and they realize that the policy in Syria and the policy towards Iran is not in their best interest anymore. And so all we can do is beat them over the head with a stick, and they're not really afraid of the stick anymore. And so that's what those two things, those two conferences, really signify to me. Angela Merkel, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, stood up and was applauded, as opposed to Pence, who was, not. And on all of these same points. And the final thing to think about here is that the Germans and the French are working very hard, and the EU in general, want their own independent foreign policy, which would preclude, of course, NATO. Hmm. Which, at the end of the day, is the big 800-pound gorilla in the room that no one really in Washington really wants to touch, is that NATO has outlived its usefulness. And Trump is right. I think his instincts on this are correct, but he's not going to do anything about it. So there we are.
And Tom, I want to follow up on your mention of empire related to Trump. You said Trump is not going to have a policy. I think that's what you inferred. A policy of ending the empire, and the empire will continue. And I certainly agree with that. But all empires end eventually. And I think you're talking about the fracturing of conventional wisdom of us being involved in the world, because it looks like they may be ganging up on us. And it looks like there could be a limitation on finances. And I think back in the 60s, because they were defying, conventional wisdom, and Johnson and the others thought you could have guns and butter. So we had Vietnam War, and then we had the welfare state, and finally we had to do a little payback in the 70s. And I think it won't be exactly the same, but I think that they make an effort to have creative financing. And the only thing that they can do to continue all this financing and supporting the military-industrial complex, they have to tax a lot, they have to inflate a lot, they have to steal a lot, confiscation of wealth and bank accounts and gold and all these things. So I think that the empire will end. And I just want you to comment on that and why we shouldn't ignore the fact that when that happens, serious consequences happen when we paid back for Vietnam and welfare then. Because I see that the bubble and the debt and our involvement is more precarious than it even was back then.
Oh, it's absolutely. And it's not just us at this point, Dr. Paul. It's everyone. Europe is in the same boat. We are. Japan is in even worse shape. And actually, looking at the world the way it stands right now, we're on the verge of a sovereign debt crisis. And all of this, this geopolitical wrangling and all of this stuff going on with Nord Stream 2 and all of these things are all symptoms of the incipient sovereign debt crisis. And central banks, like generals, are always fighting in the last war. So they're still thinking they need to be ring-fenced against private debt, mortgage-backed securities, corporate debt, and the like, when the real problem is sovereign debt, which is going to go bad. And just like in the 1930s, I don't think we're going to see a replay of the 60s. We're going to see a replay of the 1930s, where we had a sovereign debt crisis all across Europe. And the United States, and Martin Armstrong makes this point saliently, that the United States is still the world's core economy. And so it'll be the last one to collapse before everybody else's does. So Europe or Japan are going to collapse first. I'm betting on Europe because they're more politically fractious than the Japanese are. And then it's going to then, once that implodes, then it's going to, the bills will come due here in the United States. And Trump is only making things worse by asking for lower interest rates to fuel his expansion and rebuilding of American infrastructure and the military and everything else, by calling for lower interest rates and protection tariffs. He's only going to make things worse. He's only destroying the global velocity of money and making the dollar more expensive, which is going to implode emerging markets, which will roll up into Europe and then into the United States. It's a very big problem, but that's like the basic thesis.
Right.
So
very
that's
good.
What I see in the long run.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Well, going back to standing up to empires, as you're both talking about in one way or the other, it was fascinating, probably little noticed in the U.S., how Hungarian Foreign Minister Peter Szijjártó delivered a stinging rebuke to Pompeo last week. Pompeo came to Hungary. It was a big deal. It was signifying the mending of long broken fences between Hungary and the United States. It was supposed to be a real huggable moment. But you had Pompeo starting to lecture Hungary about, don't you dare do business with Russia and China. They're horrible people. They don't like democracy. They're not like us. You can't trust them. And rather than do what Hungary has done since the end of the Cold War and just kowtow and say, okay, master, tell us what else to do, Szijjártó called him out and called him out as a hypocrite. The hypocrisy of telling us that we can't do business with our neighbors. I thought it was an amazing moment. And maybe you can comment, but I have it's a two-part, if you don't mind, Dr. Paul, because I would like to add to that. We're talking about Europe, but from what I understand from the piece that you wrote, essentially you're saying that, if I read it right, that Venezuela will be the sacrificial lamb, because the U.S. and the EU simply cannot come to terms on Iran and Russia, so therefore they will all come to terms on Venezuela, which unfortunately will get carved up. Am I reading this right? Is this what you're saying?
It's an interesting idea. My thoughts on Venezuela are still kind of in process. But what I'll say is what I've been thinking the last couple of days on this is that Europe still needs the virtue signal to the United States that they're not off the reservation.
Yeah.
And so they're willing to play. They're willing to go along with the operation against Maduro because it doesn't cost them anything politically with the U.S., right? It helps them. It helps Merkel still sell the Nord Stream 2 pipeline at a certain level. It still helps Serbia build their part of the Turk Stream pipeline, which, by the way, starts next month. For those of you who don't, you'll never see that headline in the Western press. As a matter of fact, Putin was in Serbia last week, and no one noted that all of this stuff is happening. I think that that's the Venezuela is really kind of beyond what Europe wants. They're only going along with it for very selfish reasons. I don't know that on the other side of it, I actually think, the more I think about it, it makes sense for the Russians and the Chinese to kind of poke the United States in our own backyard in order to continue to split our focus across all these different venues. Because while they're poking, you know, Venezuela, they're not poking in Ukraine. They're not poking in, as you know, they're trying to poke in Iran and Ukraine and Pakistan and Iran and Venezuela and all of these places all at the same time. And I think that at a certain point, you got to remember that the State Department is still terribly understaffed, mm-hmm. right? As is, you know, the diplomatic corps is still a mess. So I just don't see that the Trump administration has that much you know, energy and that much manpower to actually do all the things that they say they're going to do, and which is why they're leaving it all to Mnuchin at the Treasury Department to just sanction everyone.
Tom, what?
And Wilbur Ross of Commerce to tariff everyone.
What do you think is the glue that brings our allies together, our strong allies, Israel and Saudi Arabia? And Trump didn't wait very long to let us know how strong the alliance would be. Is there just one thing that brings them together? How did that come about to be so powerful? I mean, the adhesions, you know, coming together, and it's a powerful force.
I honestly, Dr. Paul, shouldn't answer that question simply because I would be out over my skis to think what actually brought that together. I think Trump is believes, like many of his generation, that Israel is a project worth it, almost worth sacrificing the United States for. I don't agree with that position. I'm a Gen X guy. I'm not a baby boomer, and I can see that across my generation. I don't think that's going to be there, and I think that support's not going to be there in 15, 20 years. And I think the Israelis understand that they're under a real existential threat now with the emerging alliance between Russia, Iran, and China. Not that they're going to be aggressive about this, but simply that the United States can't take them down if they stand together, and that they're just running a war of attrition against Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the United States, who are all fundamentally weak because, as we've talked about, because we're $22 trillion in debt. The Saudis are running a 20% debt to GDP ratio at $60 a barrel oil. And the Israelis don't have any kind of strategic position, right? Mm-hmm. If Syria doesn't implode, if the operation to destroy Syria doesn't work, then Israel is in a very tenuous position strategically. And I honestly think that in many ways, the Israelis are as much a victim of our own hegemony as anything else. I mean, I'm being generous here. I think there's certain aspects of the Israeli political set that are absolutely very aggressive, but I think there's a certain level. I think Israel is, they're just hitching their wagons to the biggest, they're hitching their cart to the biggest wagon and hoping to survive because they understand that it's a very tenuous position that they're in. So it's very complicated from that perspective. I think everybody's interests just kind of align that way.
Very good.
Interesting. I'm gonna close by telling people to go to your website, tomluongo.me, L-U-O-N-G-O, tomluongo.me. And if I can do a closing question, if you don't mind, Dr. Paul, we both noticed an incredible piece in the Washington Times this morning. You amazingly, you must have had an extra cup of espresso this morning because you wrote it up right away. I mean, it wasn't 10 minutes after I noticed it that you had written it up. An amazing piece on how Al-Qaeda is now in a strategic partnership with Iran, and that means we have full permission under the 2001 AUMF to hit Iran and take them out. Tell us a little bit about what
I just think it's a bunch of fiction being peddled by John Bolton in order to make to try and sell Trump's base on the idea of going to war with Iran. I think that they'll stop at nothing to get what they want at the end of the day. It was funny. I read a piece by Fred Reed the other day with a quote from John Bolton about his his college yearbook, I think, his Yale yearbook, saying that, effectively the reason he didn't go to Vietnam was because there would have been no point to him going because we wouldn't have won. So he wasn't averse to going to Vietnam in order to go kill Vietnamese. He was just like, well, there's going to be no point because I'm only going to kill them now and then they're going to run us out later. So I'm going to bide my time for the rest of my life so that I can kill Iranians later, I guess. I don't know. The man is a certified psychopath and absolutely has no business being anywhere near the presidency or the reins of power, the nuclear football or anything else, because it's just savage. And, as an analyst, I have to keep my emotions to my close to the vest most days as best I can. But the truth of the matter is I'm horrified by all this. I mean, just absolutely horrified.
Right.
But I don't think that there's an appetite here in the United States for war with Iran. I don't think that I don't think Putin's going to allow it to happen. I think he's way too skilled. He's way too skilled at outmaneuvering morons like Pompeo, Pence, and Bolton. I just do. They will continue to play their games, but they will lose. As they couldn't get Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, barred from the Munich summit, even though they tried mightily. I mean, Merkel said no. And then Lavrov held all the meetings. I mean, literally held meetings with everyone there. And he was the main event at Munich. And again, not covered anywhere in the Western press, but he was absolutely the man everybody wanted to talk to, because Europe understands that its future is lies east with Russia and not west with the United States.
Tom, I want to finish up now, but I want to ask you a short question on a different subject, and it has to do with environments. And that has to do with, the global warming and the CO2, and you've had scientific training, and I know you have a pretty precise position on that, which I think sounds pretty sound. So just make a comment on that whole subject.
Well, I'm a degreed chemist, and I worked as a research chemist for 20 years, and I've been studying the global warming thing for a long time. Aside from the fact that the data sets are, I worked for 20 years as a research chemist producing data sets that I could eat off of, that were legally clean enough that I could eat off of, right? I look at those data sets, and I look at how they've been, the temperature data sets, and I look at how they've been massaged, and I go, I would not feed these to my dog. And it's worse than that. All it's happening right now. We can see it all around us. The upper atmosphere is cooling off at a rate that we've never measured before. The sun is going into remission. There's some great work by the Russian mathematician, Valentina Zarkova, that finally linked the changes in the sun's magnetic field to its output and how that affects the Earth and how that affects global temperatures. And she's like matched the models like 97% accuracy going backwards and forwards for 10,000 years. Far more accurate than CO2. CO2 has nothing to do with climate change. It's, if anything, it's a lagging indicator as opposed to a leading one. It's actually a warning that something's changing as opposed to the cause of the change. And that's very obvious at this point. And I think even NASA is finally starting to admit this. But, you know, right, at least they're admitting that the planet's cooling off.
Yeah, Tom, this has been great. I appreciate very much you being with us today. And let's stay in touch.
Thank you, sir. You have a great day.
And I want to thank our viewers today for tuning in today, because I consider this a very special program. I enjoyed it very much. And please come back to the Liberty Report soon.